Hello, I'm Scott Soschnick, y'all.
And I'm Evan Novi Williams, and this is the 3 Days in Texas Sports Business Podcast, the Sportacast.
Had similar things, but I didn't tell you that. I didn't give you any hints that I was coming with y'all, but it was a nice tease into you saying I didn't know you were going 3 days. Was it three or four? How long were you?
It felt like 30. It feels like it's 80.
Well, you're still there.
I'm still here, so, and it feels like I've been here for half my life.
Yeah. To pay homage to Steve Summers, the overnight host at WFN Radio in New York, where I was once Great Scott the intern behind the glass, he used to say, me here, you there. So, me here in New York, you there in Texas. You and I spent some time there, like you said, South by Southwest. Since you're already there, why don't you give me the boots on the ground? How does it feel to still be in Texas? Because the festival's still going on, but we let off with the sports track.
Yeah, let me tell you, the festival changes quite a bit after the first few days, after a lot of the serious stuff, like the sports track, which we'll get into, after that ends, and then it turns into a music festival and a film festival. So I'm in the middle of the transition there, and I'm flying home today. But I thought that the 3 days that we had, and we'll get into some of the conversations, Stephen A. Smith, Charlotte Jones, and Stephen Jones, the owners of the Cowboys, a number of athletes, a number of team owners. Every year, this is a good kind of check-in on where everyone in the sports ecosystem is, again, from owners to media to the athletes themselves.
By the way, stay tuned for the end of the show because Sportico is going to make quite a splash, tease, foreshadow, in March Madness, and we won't tell you what that is about until the end of the show. I mean, not that you don't want to stick around anyway, but I mean, come on. If we have a chance to tease that way, let's do it. Yeah, let's start with Stephen A. Because I sat with him for about an hour, and I think we went much longer because we decided to open it up to Q&A. You know, we asked Stephen ahead of time, you want to take some questions from the crowd. First of all, absolutely packed ballroom. I mean, absolutely packed. Second of all, lots of questions. I mean, there was a line. We had to cut it short and say, okay, that's enough. And he and I, before we went on stage, had quite a chat about sort of the old days, like 30 years ago, he and I hanging around, you know, the Core State Center or whatever the name of the building was at the time in Philadelphia. And just the empire that he has built. If you're thinking of Stephen A. simply as this sort of loud, opinionated give my hot take guy, you do not understand what he is building behind the scenes with the Stephen A. Smith Show. And an executive producing a bunch of projects. I'll let you talk about some of the specifics there. But Stephen, besides telling just sort of his story and what he's building, I thought he was most passionate when he was sort of almost like a professor. When he was teaching people by, you know, what do they say? What is it? A smart man learns from his own mistakes. A truly wise man learns from the mistakes of others. Well, Stephen A. was saying, these were my mistakes. Let me tell you the mistake I made when I was first jettisoned from Disney. He said, it was my fault. No, hold on. Let me say it like he said it. It was my fault. I was not grown up. I was a little kid. And he talked about going home and his mother bringing him breakfast in bed with a mirror on it saying, this is not the son I know. Look at yourself in the mirror. Pick yourself up. And you know, we'll get into exactly what he said. But it was a really, really heartfelt soliloquy from Stephen about mistakes made, lessons learned, picking yourself up, moving on, and building something special.
He was on the vanguard of media personalities, and it's true across media, but we'll talk about sports media. Sports media personalities who became businesses in their own right. It's not unlike the transition we've talked about with athletes, where athletes went from more or less just being paid to play sports to leveraging their fandom into all these other things. And as you said, it's very clear that early in his career, he was slow to recognize his value. And I agree with you. I think if people, really any industry, but if you're working in this industry and you want to learn about leverage and how to value yourself versus the company that employs you, I really recommend people listen to it. Because it's clear, as he said, that if you don't figure out and if you can't calculate your own value, someone else is going to calculate your value for you, and you might not like the number.
My guess is that calculation will be less than what you think it's worth.
And you see this in his career, right? In his back and forths with Disney, the launch of his own business, his own media empire as well, and how that media empire works and licenses contents with Disney. You can see kind of the threads of him picking up on how valuable he was, because years ago ESPN was the thing, and everyone who was there was more or less subservient and serving Disney. And now and we talk about this with Pat McAfee, for example, Scott, which you mentioned to Steven as well, that there are athletes or there are media personalities at Disney who are way more important to the Disney brand than just being highly paid employees.
How about the part where Steven went into the need to understand that you cannot react with emotion? And when his first negotiation with Disney, he's like, I brought emotion to the table. You know what the Disney executives brought? They brought empirical data. And the data is going to win. They said, we will define your value through, here's the ratings book, here's the demographics, here's what we charge advertisers per 15-minute block. This is how much we can capitalize on what you are creating. He didn't want to hear it. Like, he brought emotion. Now, the next time, he was almost like Scott Boras, the famed agent who is known for bringing these reams of data books and saying why his clients are worth X number of dollars. Well, Stephen A. came armed with data. He said, I had to speak their language. I had to understand how they were calculating my worth, and then brought the data to them saying, here I am, and from 10 to 10, 15, look at the demographics in my show. Other people are talking about the same topics. I told him, like, back in the day when we used to write a story that had Tiger Woods or Goldman Sachs in the headline, anybody would read it. Didn't matter. It was just those two things. He said, oh, yeah? Well, I've got the data that shows if I talk about the Dallas Cowboys, we do X. If another host talk about the Dallas Cowboys, it's Y. More people are watching me because they are coming for my take on the news. So he really is a really, really good lesson for younger folks. And he was passionate about it. It was really, really interesting to see the maturation of Stephen A., the businessman, and how that is progressing with his business. Remember when he was talking about when he was going to take, let's say, a spirited take. Somebody had gone after another media personality, had gone after him quite publicly, right? And Stephen A. decided he was going to respond publicly on the Stephen A. Smith show. Now, the difference between the two, had it been on his ESPN show, he could not have said and done what he did. Now, he owns, O&O it's called, owns and operates the Stephen A. Smith show. Smartly, however, he recognized that his bosses at Disney, simply because they gave him the right to do that show while working at ESPN, there is a trust factor in those things, the long-standing relationship. Stephen A. gave them a heads up. He wasn't seeking permission. There's a huge difference here. But he understood the value of the trust and the relationship that he went to his Disney bosses and said, I just feel as if you need a heads up that I'm about to go DEFCON 1 nuclear on my show, which may then attach itself to me and ESPN. Again, didn't ask for permission, but gave them a heads up. Very interesting case study on how to go about your business when you are working both for yourself and for somebody else.
And I see parallels between the conversation that you had with Stephen and then the keynote a few days later, which was Charlotte and Stephen Jones.
Yep. Yes.
Because they talked about the way in which the Cowboys and their father, after buying the team in 1989, also upended the business of the NFL by giving owners taking back rights that they felt were theirs, right? And in a lot of ways, Stephen A. Smith is talking about media people kind of taking back rights of their own, right? Being able to build the thing that they want to build on the back of their own IP, right? The Stephen A. Smith Show, that's his own IP. That is exactly or similar to kind of what Jerry Jones did back in the early 90s when he went to war with other NFL owners, went to war with the league, about what the league was allowed to sell in sponsorships, what the teams were allowed to sell in sponsorship, who controlled IP, of the star. It's one of the most iconic sports logos out there. It's one of the reasons why the Cowboys are the most valuable team, sports team in the world in any league. But definitely some similarities there between two people who were visionaries who realized something was a little bit off in the economics and then forced change that benefited themselves.
Absolutely. And I love the story. I think my favorite part was when Steven and Charlotte were talking about the NFL telling the teams, hey, we're going to do a league-wide deal. I believe the product was Coke.
Yeah.
Right. We're going to do a league-wide deal with Coke. Now, if that happened, the teams could then, they were disallowed. They could not go and sign a local team deal with, say, Pepsi, just to keep it easy, Pepsi versus Coke. Now, what sort of leverage, Steven said, do you think, and this is what Jerry had went and told the other owners, he goes, you guys are fighting me. He goes, I don't really think you guys understand what you're fighting for. He goes, I'll tell you what, if you win, right, you're going to make less money. If you win, you're going to have to take the team back, right? He said, because I'm not, I won't be able to pay you. Whatever they were seeking is I won't have the money to pay you. If you win, you're going to take my team away from me. If I win, you're all going to make a whole lot more money because you will be able to do these different deals. And that's exactly, they reached a settlement. There was no decision.
Yeah.
But they reached, and it is sort of the standard for, current marketing in the NFL, where each team, they share the national revenue. It's sort of a bit of both here, like a happy compromise. They share national revenue, like the national TV. But surely the Dallas Cowboys and other teams now go in their local market and sell products and brands that are counter to the national deal, something they can do better in their own market, and they keep a lot of that revenue. That's how the Cowboys differentiate themselves.
You talk a lot on the show about Wellington Mara and the
yes, I
kind
do.
Of the original yeah. business model of the NFL. The
hey, you listen.
I do.
You actually
I do
listen.
Indeed.
Did I ever tell you about David Stern and Tim Pupukon?
I've never heard of either of those people.
Should we do that now? Hey, Evan. So I'm quelling.
If Wellington is kind of the first piece of the really successful NFL business model, which is collectivizing some of those rights, then in the 90s, Jerry Jones essentially was the yin to that yang, right? Forcing the other piece of that structure, which is incentivizing companies to pay up individual teams and teams to monetize their IP, their stadium, their players in new ways. And those are that's kind of the two-headed monster that has built the most profitable, richest sports league in the world. And Jerry Jones, you mentioned the media there. Stephen Jones said on the show when the Jones family bought the Cowboys, there were two main issues. The sponsorship issue was big, as you said, and they fought that and eventually won. And then TV was the other one. There were essentially three main TV networks. The NFL was giving a discount to those networks. And Jerry convinced everybody that, you know what, maybe we should treat this more like an open marketplace. They just signed $120 billion worth of media deals a couple years ago. Again, the backbone, the strength of the NFL business and why it is so successful. The Jones family played a large role in achieving at least two of those things early in its tenure in the 90s.
Jerry Cardinale of Redbird Capital sort of hosted that discussion.
Yeah.
He's done business with the Cowboys as well. And Legends is something that, how to utilize the brand to do other things. And the term Jerry used once or twice that I had never really thought of it this way. I mean, there's other terms there out front. I get it. But I really think it's appropriate for the Cowboys. He called them the pace car, like always out front, setting the pace for everybody else. And I found extremely interesting Stephen's reminding. You can't really enjoy this story with a modern lens. You know, because everything is just, of course, all sports marketing is the way it is, and they can cut their own deals, and they get all this media money. You have to transport yourself back into a different world where these things did not exist. You have to go back to a time when the Dallas Cowboys were on the market and nobody wanted them. Now, you can't even fathom that today. If the Dallas Cowboys hit the open market, and we value the Cowboys the most expensive team in pro sports. We value them at $9.2 billion. Let's be serious, Novi Williams. If the Dallas Cowboys today if for whatever reason the Jones family suddenly put out a press release, we're selling the Cowboys, but we're just tired of this football thing, we can't win, we just want to sell the Cowboys, how many entities would come to the table, and how far above $9.2 billion do you think that would go? It answers itself.
I mean, one of the, you said entities there. There's right now the current rules make the Cowboys so difficult to sell, right? I'm sounding like a broken record here, but the amount of cash you need to get that deal done is immense, right?
Elon Musk would buy the Dallas Cowboys.
$4 billion.
Elon Musk would buy the Dallas Cowboys. I'm on record. Musk would buy. Even if he has no interest, he would see this and say, "I'm buying the Dallas Cowboys."
Yes, there's not that many people in the world that have the liquidity to make that happen, but that small pool would still be bidding against itself, I think. Mike Bloomberg
versus Warren Buffett versus Elon Musk versus Jeff Bezos. I love this.
Absolutely. But I think, Scott, if the Jones family were to announce tomorrow, we're selling the Cowboys, I think the NFL would change its ownership rules.
Or yeah. Even just for this one transaction.
Maybe even just that. But yeah, the difference between those two sale processes with the current rules in place or with a slight change about the cash that you have to put down or about institutional money or about the number of investors you can have in the group, you can move a little of those levers and I think drive the price up considerably.
This chat was, in essence, if you boil it down, it was a Harvard Business School case study. I mean, that's really what it is. And we're going to get, I didn't know this, by the way, at the time. Did you know this is the first time that Stephen and Charlotte had ever done this conversation without their father, Jerry?
I didn't.
Which...
One of the things I was going to say, and maybe I did mention to you afterwards, is that I often feel like sometimes the children of big, high-profile owners don't love talking about their father or their mother. Like I actually think the way that the siblings, specifically Stephen and Charlotte, talk about Jerry with admiration and with a lot of tenderness is really nice and refreshing because, as you know, talking to owners that are further down in the generations from the original or maybe even the highest profile owner often feel a little bit uneasy about those conversations.
Yeah, and Stephen worked in oil and gas. He was an engineer in oil and gas, and Charlotte seems to have become like a branding guru. You know, people go to her advice, ask for her advice in multiple tracks. So to see the kids talk, like as you said, so lovingly and admiringly,
admiringly,
give me a tense. But one interesting point, well, many interesting points, but they brought this up specifically, which I did not know. Jerry did not want to do the star.
Yeah.
Jerry had no more appetite for risk. He had gone to his kids. They brought the idea to him that we should do this. How do we capitalize on the core brand Dallas Cowboys in another way? So if you know what the star is now in Frisco, Texas, and there's plenty of good drone footage that you can go find, but it's a practice, in essence, a huge practice facility with ancillary businesses like hotel, conference center, and the practice facility also serves as the home for a bunch of the high school football teams there. So you'll have sort of the star high school players working out and going to the same doctors. There's a Baylor Medical Center or whatever it is right there where they get treated along right where the Dallas Cowboys do. It's sort of what they built in New England, Patriot Place. People want to be close to the brand. There's a gym where you can go see, like, no, you're not working out next to Dak Prescott, but you can probably look through the glass and be like, hey, look, the Cowboys are over there working out. And so if that's where they work out, that's where I want to work out. And the fact that that brand has been extended into real estate makes perfect sense for sort of the modern platform company that we always talk about. And that thing's spinning off tons of cash. It's one of the reasons why the Cowboys, when you take all the ancillary businesses and related entities, why they are number one on our list of most valuable franchises.
One more little thing that I'll say that stuck out from that conversation. Charlotte Jones talked a bit about Legends, the hospitality business that the Cowboys, Goldman Sachs, and the New York Yankees launched back in 2008, something right around there. And the success of that business, which has now expanded into advisory, helping design stadiums, helping to sell sponsorships, helping to do hospitality, catering, all that stuff. She said that the Cowboys look at that business as helping fund its portion of the AT&T Stadium. I think it's fascinating to see how a team that has led the way both internally in the NFL and obviously led the way in development and spinning off other businesses, the way in which that financially benefits them. And also, yeah, you see, as you said, all the reasons why this is the most, this is the highest valued sports team in the world.
And there is a documentary coming out. You know, Netflix has a documentary on the Cowboys. And Stephen and Charlotte both said, we've been approached by a number of parties over time to do a doc about the team. And all of them had the same vision, I think. And it did not align with the Jones family vision. The vision probably had a lot to do with sort of the winning team of yesteryear, Michael Irvin, all that stuff. It was probably a lot of football stuff, Jimmy Johnson, that era. The Joneses thought the real interesting story was the family, the struggle, the build, the success, the failures. They wanted to show that, and I guess Netflix agrees, because we don't know the exact number, but it is the highest price ever paid for a sports doc and should be around a year from now, whatever. And I think people are really going to enjoy it, because that talk, getting to see and hear from them, sans Jerry, which obviously gave them more air in the room, but being able to hear like Jerry's vision or Jerry's take, and then to hear the kids who are going to continue it, I think it's going to be an extremely popular documentary when it comes out.
Anything else from South By, to other panels that jumped out to you? One thing that I was listening to that I thought was great. There was a panel on one of the days about international expansion for sports, and the person who runs the NFL's overseas business was there, and so was a woman who runs Bayern Munich's overseas business. And they had a really interesting conversation about the differences between how those two teams or leagues view open markets. The main
question
difference,
for you: when you say Bayern Munich's overseas business, does that mean the U.S. or does that
mean? Yeah, yeah, that means like non-European business.
Got it. Okay.
And the main difference between those two things being that when the NFL goes into or thinks about new markets, it is both trying to commercialize the NFL, and maybe most importantly, trying to educate people on what American football is and try to get people to play it. Whereas when Bayern Munich goes into essentially any market in the world, they're not trying to educate people about soccer. They're not trying to get more people to play soccer. They are really primarily focused on the Bundesliga and Bayern Munich and that commercial opportunity. So they had a really fun conversation that maybe we can put on our social or on our YouTube at some point. But about the different ways in which you approach new markets when getting kids to play your sport is a priority versus what it looks like when everybody knows what your sport is and really what you're caring about is just the company that you work for.
Yeah, well, when you're locked in that Southwest bubble, it's like I think you and I just made, you know, straight line back and forth between the hotel and where we were
totally,
you know, the sports track. So just cut that rug back, you know, back and forth. So there were a couple of other items that did come up that we obviously have not talked about yet, but I don't think it got enough coverage, but the NBA exploring starting its own league in Europe, to me, was a massive business story, or at least the possibility of one, and also kind of shots fired, right, against EuroLeague. And you know, you know, they've probably been trying to talk about doing things together. They started a league in Africa, right? There's NBA China. Now, everybody knows the popularity of basketball in Europe, and just look at the players that have come here. An NBA O&O branded league, I would have to think, would be very popular in Europe. Definitely one that you should worth watching moving forward.
Yeah, so a couple of thoughts here. This is a story that our colleague Kurt Bodenhausen broke this week, along the lines of international expansion. According to Kurt, the NBA currently generates only a few $100 million a year in Europe. That was shocking to me, and I guess that is exactly the reason why these talks are happening, right? Because it does certainly seem as so many stars, increasingly it feels like, more and more NBA stars are coming from Europe. The sport is obviously tremendously popular in a number of countries.
The power of that brand in those countries?
Agreed. So just to hear that there was a few $100 million, the league is working with Rain Group on this. And according to Kurt, they think this could be a multi-billion-dollar business, a $3 billion in annual revenue across the Europe and the Middle East, which is an important part of this, which we can get into as well. But yeah, if you're working with a group that thinks this could be anything could be a $3 plus billion a year business, and it's currently a couple hundred million dollar a year business. You just see right there the potential opportunity to do something big in Europe if you're the NBA.
Well, we know the NBA goes and plays preseason games in Abu Dhabi. We know that the Qatari Sovereign Fund is making investments into NBA, NHL. There is no reason to think that the flow of capital and the flow of interest in each direction will wane anytime soon. So certainly one that's worth watching. And another one that worth watching is Rob McElhenney. You know, I just always think of him as tethered, right? It's just Ryan Reynolds and Rob McElhenney. And never the twain shall separate. But like, you know, just they're doing everything, especially, I guess, the most popular investment they have would be Wrexham. No surprise there. But Rob is creating an advisory and production business. And I would be interested to see why Rob feels the need he has to do that separate from Ryan and what sorts of projects he's going to go after.
Yeah, the Wrexham story is so good for so many reasons, but the thing that stands out to me is just how finger on the pulse those two guys have been about how to tell that story properly. And you've asked the question a bunch about how easy or hard is it to replicate what they did. I think it's very, very difficult.
McElhenney.
But they really, and Rob and both of them, Rob and Ryan, really seem like they have a very specific skill set that could be very valuable across not just entertainment, but now we're seeing across sports. So I understand what he's doing. It seems like this company may at some point have equity in other teams as well. I would be fascinated to see if that's in women's soccer, if that's in men's soccer, if that's further afield than where they are right now. But an interesting move by him, and to me, honestly, Scott, one that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, you know what else makes sense? That we at Sportico would bring our Invest in Sports franchise from New York to Los Angeles, which we are doing. May 8th, at the One Hotel in West Hollywood, we are putting on our Invest in Sports franchise. How about a sit down with Todd Boehly? That sound good to you? You want to hear from Todd? A number of the biggest names in sports and ownership, tangential sports ownership, finance will be there. So check it out and join us in LA. And now I'd have to rely on you because we teased our big splash at the start of the show. Now tell everybody what in the world I'm talking about.
We are, Sportico is partnering with Splash Inc., a gaming site that I've written a bit about. They do both free and for money office pools. Sportico is partnering with Splash for pools around March Madness, the men's basketball tournament coming up.
They do. There are pools around March Madness?
There's pools around March
Madness. That happens?
It does, believe it or not. And then
I'm going to ask you to tell me who to fill in on the bracket. Now, I need you to tell me who's going to win. I'll change one or two. Yeah. I won't take your. I'm going to put Syracuse through to the Final Four. And are they even making the tournament? Do they make the tournament?
I have no idea. I think not.
I don't know
but
either.
But I'm not sure.
Okay, just asking.
Yeah. So Scott and I sat at South by sat down with Kyle Christensen, who is the chief marketing and chief revenue officer.
Because we see ourselves as a marketplace. Like, the biggest hotel company in the world doesn't own a hotel or a property, Airbnb. The biggest transportation company in the world, Uber, doesn't own a car. We want to be the biggest gaming platform and not have to facilitate any games. We just survive. We supply a commissioner who's a creator and a player who's the demand side.
One of the things I think is interesting about that is in talking to folks at DraftKings and FanDuel, you probably felt this way at PointsBet too, everyone was trying to figure out how to social mediaize their product. And at least where I sit, nobody did it. Nobody figured that out. Nobody was able to hack it. And it sounds like you guys are thinking less social media-wise and more like personal community-wise, right? It's your office. It's your group of friends. It's the people that you talk to, your fan group on Syracuse or whatever it is. So less about like national community and more about more local community. Am I thinking about that right?
Yeah, I think you nailed it. And there's no reason, we're starting to think through social tools like chat and forums and posting where people can use Splash not only as a gaming platform but then come in and talk crap about why I picked the Broncos for the third week in a row and you know what I mean. It's like that really kind of creates this ecosystem that we want to build.
Can other platforms help to at least accelerate your growth or boost your users? Could you partner with some of those platforms that everyone was talking about?
I wouldn't say in the gaming space. I don't think we're ready, nor do we want to. But you know, what's really caught my eye is working with brands. You know, I've been on the client side in the past and working with big brands, and you always try and find ways to grow your audience and capture more and more data. And I see no reason why a bigger brand wouldn't want to come and create a game with us and ultimately take that wherever they go.
Splash did a really interesting thing with the NBA this year. We talked a lot on the show about the in-season tournament. And like, if you're the NBA, how do you get fans to like recognize the rules, understand what's at stake in these games and how the different tiers are going to match up and who goes on? The NBA partnered with Splash, and by creating a game around the in-season tournament, also helped educate fans about how this thing is going to work, who's in what group, top two move on, all those things. So I imagine there's an opportunity there too with just leagues that, and brands probably that just want to educate fans about the way new things are working.
I mean, what better way to understand how something works than to play in a game where you have to, otherwise you'll lose. So if you do have that competitive spirit, you're getting in the weeds. And you know, we saw pretty nice success with that.
Like, it's been only a few years, like you mentioned, and since PASPA was overturned, I get it. But it's not as if we don't have places around the world where we have long timelines where this has been going on. What are the lessons learned? Can we figure that patterns of human behavior will repeat themselves?
I love this question, by the way, because I think, yes, we definitely can. And when I look at an online sports book, we absolutely have to look at all the factors. But if you think about it, in the U.S., like, gambling has been illegal until PASPA was passed. And what did people do, like myself, you know, when they were 20 years old, when they were 30 years old? They played in fantasy. They played in contests with all of their buddies. And so I think the U.S. market is a little bit different, where there's different types of games that we're used to, first and foremost, before we bet the
over. So let me ask you, DFS, that user all of a sudden say, oh great, I can now wager money, so I'm going there. Was it a quick flight, or was it an addition to, I'm still going to do my fantasy, not for money, but I'm also want to, you know, bet individual games each night?
I think it's the latter, but I think it's an easy transition from fantasy to say, oh, I'm taking Saquon Barkley this week, or, you know, I got Mike Evans this week, into, I think he's going to have over 1.5 touchdowns. Like, you know what I mean? Like, you can see this player adapting week by week in your contest. Why not take him single-handedly in 1 week for a game?
Kyle, before we let you go, tell our listeners how to play in the Sportico Splash March Madness and then Masters Challenge.
Yep, so if you are, you know, not interested in playing for money and just want to play in a March Madness Survivor with, you know, a lot of different folks throughout the country last
and
year.
And laugh at Scott when he gets eliminated in the first hour.
We have no idea about the details. You just sprung this on us. Should we let the winner do the open to one of the shows?
We got it, like, please.
Yeah, that'd
please,
be
I would love that. Okay. Yeah.
But last year we had...
I mean, it can't get any worse.
Right. Last year we had 75,000 people play in the contest. There's amazing prizes that we've worked out. So head on over to Sportico and check it out. And then for the Masters, if you're into real money gaming, we got a pretty compelling offering that will go live here in the next couple of weeks with some great prizes.
Who does everybody pick? Well, who's the favorite golfer?
Ooh, I mean, I'm going to go with Scotty.
John Rahm?
Ooh, don't say that.
Who is it?
I'm going to go with Scotty Scheffler.
Scotty Scheffler, yeah. Okay.
He's playing well. If he can figure out his putter, it's lights out.
He is Scott Soschnick. You can find him on Twitter at Soschnick. I am Evan Novi Williams. You can find me on Twitter at Novi_Williams. The show is
everybody
produced
by hates
Erin
the Greenewald, underscore.
Who has to do a lot for this episode, so we appreciate her.
Thank you, Erin.
Sportico's digital media editor, Cora Bellman, would like you to know that you can follow the show at Sporticast, which is the hub of the Sportico.